because I mean the microscopy strived, like spend years and years to acquire all this imagery with stunning details, and then after compression you lose all details. I mean it doesn't make sense, right? So it's very important to keep all the details, and that is what we are aiming for.
And with that, welcome to Nachgeforscht. You are listening to the podcast of the Leibniz Institut für Analytische Wissenschaften, ISAS for short. Scientists here work with the aim of detecting cardiovascular diseases, cancer, or age-related illnesses earlier and being able to treat them better. They do this, for example, by researching biomarkers and drug targets or developing new imaging techniques. At ISAS, we always rely on teamwork. Here at the Institute, researchers from biology, physics, chemistry, and also computer science work together. My name is Cheyenne Peters, and in this podcast, I talk to employees here at the Institute about their research and what else motivates them. If you'd like to find out more about ISAS now, why not check out our website at ISAS Compact or X, formerly known as Twitter, at ISAS_Leibniz. Today, we're technically not in a lab, at least not a biology or a chemistry lab. This is more like an office. There's a lot of screens and a big computer here. And with me is Dr. Zhenxu Shen. He is head of the junior research group Ambiom here at ISAS. Hi, Zhenxu.
Hello.
Your group's name Ambiom is short for Analysis of Microscopic Biomedical Images. The name kind of gives away what you do. Do you want to give us a quick intro into what that means, and then we'll go into depth later?
Yes. So by name, it tells like we analyze microscopy images for biomedical research. So since the last maybe 20 years, and people start to use microscope more than just looking at something. They want to quantify things in a larger scale. So to do that, we need computer programs to do that. So that's what we are doing. So we develop computer algorithms, softwares, tools to help people analyze their biomedical images at large scales to answer their biomedical questions.
Hmm. So your work has a clear focus on like AI and also machine learning in biomedical research. You're basically right between two fields of science then. So you're in between the computer part and also the biology part. You actually started with a degree in applied mathematics. How did you end up in bioimaging?
Yeah, that's a very cool journey, I would say. And I'm very excited to talk about this because like I always feel like the moment I shift to biology was really a big milestone in my life, my personal life. So the reason mostly, I mean, the journey starts from my PhD where I shift from applied mathematics to computer science, where I find like I'm tired of like writing functions on a piece of paper. I try to like convert these functions, these equations into computer programs. So that was the initial motivation. Then during my study as a computer science PhD student, I got a chance from my PhD advisor to test the method that we develop on some microscopy images. Then I realized, okay, the method I developed could be used to classify one picture as cat or dog, and can also be used to classify a picture of cell as like cancer or not. So in that case, I feel like, oh my goodness, I can work so close to the human health, and that made me so excited, and that was the moment where I decided, okay, maybe I should study more on the biomedical side. But I did very poor in high school biology, and then later, after having this motivation, I spent a lot of time to have a better understanding of the context of those microscopy images and why we care about that. Then the more I studied, the more excitement I got from this process. So that is the basically why I switched to or spend more time on this interdisciplinary field where we try to apply computer science techniques to solve biomedical questions.
And how was that switch for you? Because you said you spent some time getting into the context, but this is like a whole new field of study. Did you do that through books or people?
Whatever resource I can find. So that, like, by those days, like, there was nothing like ChatGPT. Things can help me to catch up on the resources. Sometimes we need to go to a library to check out books, and we need to, like, go attend a conference to talk to those like state of the art method developers, and we also go attend some summer schools workshops to catch up on some hands-on skills. And we just, I mean, at that moment, I was just, like, because I was so motivated, I just tried to took advantage of every single opportunity to catch up on the related knowledges. Yeah.
Hmm. And these days, you're actually the one teaching also, because you have PhDs in your group that you actually transfer the knowledge to. You already gave us a quick intro into your group, Ambium, here at ISAS. You came to ISAS in September 2021,
yes.
Right? Let's look at it a little bit closer and into your work also. You said you work with large microscopy image data, but you don't take the images yourself. Obviously, you get the images and work with the data and basically make it more accessible, I guess, for other researchers. What does that mean? What does your work, like, on a daily basis look like?
I think we have two arms. One is a pure method developing directions. The other is more interdisciplinary collaborations. So on a method developing directions, we spend time on just literally, we have a very well-defined problem. It could be a computer science problem, computer vision problems. With this clear definition, clearly defined a problem, we just try to find the right computer algorithm to solve the problem. That is one part of our work. Just for example, we want to detect or analyze a lot of images, but how we can make the process faster? Then one of the PhD students in our group investigated how we can improve the model speed when we apply on a lot of images. This is a very clear defined problem. We just want to make the same thing running like 5 times faster or 8 times faster. The more, the better. And then we try to solve this problem from a method perspective. We also have collaborative directions or collaborative works where we really need to work closely with our biologists or biomedical researchers here at ISAS who really create those images. So as you mentioned, that we don't create any images, but we try to help or try to collaboratively help to take better images. Just take one example. So we try to introduce this AI mindset to our biomedical people. Just give you a very simple example. If you take a picture of, a whole room, regularly from the picture, you can see everything. For the purpose of analysis, this is not good because you have so many things. You have sofa, you have desk, you have chairs, you have curtains, you have, or maybe you are microwaves, whatever. There are so many things there. But if you just want to analyze how large is your, say, or how many cups you have inside the room. In microscopy or in cell biology, there's one specific way where you just add fluorescent markers to your samples.
Fluorescent markers are based on a principle called fluorescence. Fluorescence describes the property of a substance to absorb shortwave light and emit it again at a different wavelength. The electrons of a molecule are then briefly excited before they fall back to their original energy level. This releases energy that we then perceive as light. The substance therefore fluoresces. In order to be able to recognize certain structures with a fluorescence microscope, scientists add dyes to their samples that have the aforementioned properties, so-called fluorescent markers or fluorochromes. Depending on the kind of marker, they adhere to specific structures, almost like a little flag, and therefore make them visible under special fluorescence microscopes like the ones that scientists at ISAS use.
Just take the same example. If you put some special fluorescent markers on your cup, so when you use the special camera work to take the picture, only those cups will be visible. So in that case, if you want to count how many cups in your rooms from this picture, it's super easy because you can only see those cups on these images. Then you just count, okay, here are my three cups. That's super easy. However, this comes with a price. So it's not that easy to tag all the structures like with the fluorescent markers or somehow. And then we developed some AI method that can predict how the fluorescent marker may look like. So just think about, like, we have a model. Whenever you give me an image of your whole room, I can tell you how these fluorescently marked cups look like in your room, any room. So just like we virtually tag the items in this picture that you want to tag with for your fluorescent markers. So with these techniques, you don't really need those fluorescent markers anymore, but you can still get the quality of images like comparable to your fluorescent marked images.
Mm-hmm. And why is it important?
So in that case, you reduce the amount of work from a biomedical experimental perspective. So we need to explain the possibility to our biomedical collaborators, and then they can start to think from using this mindset, and they can design special experimental assays to accommodate or to utilize such techniques. So for example, one of the projects being developed at ISAS is to virtually tag all the cells that might be undergoing cell death without fluorescent markers. Previously, people have to do it with very, very special, not that easy to tag things with careful fluorescent markers. But if we can use these techniques to predict how this fluorescent marker looking like without actually tag them with fluorescent markers, that would make this cell death detection way more easier in a high throughput.
Now, when it comes to AI in biomedical research, like we said, it can bring a lot of progress, and there's a lot coming. You have a lot of papers coming out with all of these methods. And like, there's a lot of progress, as you explained, but it can also bring in some issues. One of these that you regularly address in your work, but that you also address in papers, is resource awareness. So resource awareness is something that moves a lot of people around the world in every like field of research and like a lot of topics. But research itself usually isn't really a topic when it comes to this, or isn't really in the discussion or a focus point. But you actually stressed the importance in a paper from 2023 that was published in Nature Machine Intelligence. You, or like all the authors, wrote, quote, that AI in healthcare is facing critical sustainability issues. What kind of issues are we talking about?
Yes, so this particular sustainability issue can be viewed from several different aspects. So first, the first thing came into our mind is about like carbon footprint and or energy consumptions. So as people may heard about like running artificial intelligence model will use tons of like energy and generate a lot of like CO2 or whatever, and that will be a huge burden for our environment. So that will cause like the first sustainability consideration. Another sustainability issue would be storage. So basically, tons of data are being generated all over the world. So from like you did your regular like CT or MRI or X-ray scan, or from biology labs where we collect our microscopy images and we did our drug screening experiment, collect like several terabytes images. All this data needs to be stored somewhere. And not only like it's a big burden for the storage, but also it will make future reference much harder. If you think about, you just have like 10 images And in the next 10 years, if you want to find any of them, it's so easy. If you think about you have like several million images and you want to find a particular image that you created like last year or the 3 years ago, and it will become a huge burden for in terms of management. And in the age of AI, the data is a new gold, right? So we need to have a proper management, and to build our next generation AI models, we need all this data. And finally is the knowledge. Knowledge could also pose a very great sustainability challenge, in the sense that right now, AI is not that smart yet, so we still need some human feedback. And that's actually how ChatGPT and lots of the large language model being developed. So because like we need to provide human feedback in an efficient way. However, in the field of healthcare, such people can provide valuable feedback is really limited. If, for example, if you want to provide some feedback of your MRI CT scan, you need the doctor's opinion. And then, for example, if you need to better understand some microscopy images, you need those special biologists who have seen so many images in their research to comment on that. And all these things require special knowledge. And such knowledge sometimes live in those experts' mind, but this may not be sustainable. So we want to find a way to utilize this special, such expertise, such expert knowledge in an efficient way. We want to make the AI model more sustainable in the sense that they can be more independent or less relying on special expert feedback.
You say that you want to not want to limit the expert knowledge, but you want to kind of make it more sustainable, but you don't want to take out the human. So you want to...
Of course, that's important. So that's why we believe a human will play a critical role. However, we just want to make really good use of their time. So just for example, previously, people, if you need to train an AI model to classify cancer or not cancer cell, and then you need to collect a lot of images with cancer and not cancer cells, and then you need to have an expert sit in front of the computer to click a program, say, this cell is cancer, this cell is not cancer. You did this for several thousand times. That will take just too much time. And we believe this is not a sustainable way if we want to develop more models. So we try to develop a specific method called active learning. By active, we mean we want to make this learning more proactive in terms of utilizing the human's knowledge. So, for example, we just say we get some initial supervision from human. Say, you can just tell me for these 10 images, which are cancer, which are not cancer. By 10 is fine. They can do it at a coffee break or whatever. So, but of course, these 10 images are not enough to build a big model, a very reliable model. Then we will train the preliminary model. And then we apply this model on more images and find those cases where the model is most uncertain about, or the model finds most trouble with. And then we provide this most critical example to the human expert again, maybe another 10 or another 20. And then these are the most important examples at the moment or for the model to learn. Then with the human feedback, the model can get another round of improvement. Then we do this again. And we keep by doing this in a like so-called human loop way. And we can we can spend the human's time on the most important thing so that we can efficiently utilize human expertise. literally. Yeah.
And you obviously don't just criticize the models, but you also develop strategies and tools to limit not only the energy use, but also resource consumption in general. So also the people, like you said. Do you want to talk maybe a little bit about that, like about some strategies that you developed or that you're working on?
So basically, in our Nature Machine Intelligence paper, we identify those different aspects of sustainability. Then we try to address them one by one. So from the energy point of view, we developed this so-called efficient bio-AI toolkit or some kind of open source software where you just give me like whatever model you want to run for bioimage analysis. We just take the model and then run the model through our software, more like a wrapper. So you run the model through our wrapper, and then you will enjoy like several times speed up and also more than 80% of energy consumption reduction. So this is one very concrete step we are trying to reduce the energy part. The second part is about storage. So because of the fast development of the microscopy technology, there are all kinds of new microscopy coming out like every year, and we start to have higher resolution, higher throughput, all these kind of new techniques being developed. And as a return, the images, or we have images of larger size, and we also have much more images that we can acquire than before. So as a result, like how we can better store this like microscopy images, then we developed two different image compression methods using two different techniques. And we haven't finalized which is the best yet. We are just trying out different possibilities that we can think of. And both methods achieved very promising results in terms of compress the microscopy images without losing the critical information. So we are not like chasing the goal of keeping every single piece of information, because when you acquire microscopy images, by nature, it contains noise. We want to lose the noise. We don't want to keep them. So we developed some special compression method that can compress image even with losing something on purpose, and then reduce the file size by a decent amount. For example, one method can compress image into their like 80% or 90% of their original size. The other method can do even more. So I think one of the benchmark we did is like a 512 times compression. So that's a huge amount in terms of saving the storage size. And the most important thing is the key information in the image will be kept. Because, I mean, the microscopy strived, like, spend years and years to acquire all this imagery with stunning details. And then after compression, you lose all details. I mean, it doesn't make sense, right? So it's very important to keep all the details. And that is what we are aiming for.
And when you determine what the key aspects are, what the important things are, how do you probably collaborate with the scientists? How does that look like? Because you come from very different fields.
Yes. So we provide some general guidance on how we can evaluate the result. From another paper, like we published last year on Nature Method, like a comment paper, so which we called the application appropriate validation. So in order to validate whether your result is good or not, you need application. You need to understand your application. For example, if you have an image of like several thousand nuclei, if my goal is to count the nuclei, then if I lose a little bit of information about the boundary or make it a little bit blurry, it's fine as long as I can count. If my goal is to quantify the exact shape, for example, some nuclei may be squeezed, some may be undergoing, when they're going on mitosis, the shape will have some special morphological information there. If we want to keep all the details about their shape, then we cannot afford to lose any bit information about their morphology. But we can still afford to lose something about their texture. So but whenever you want to verify your result is good or not, you always need to think about your application. Then for our paper, we did the same. So we verified our result in different applications. Throughout our experiment, we did find like one application where the compression result was not good enough. So for those cases, we should refrain from ourselves to using that. So we are not saying that it's good for all, but we provide some guidance on how to properly validate your result so that you can determine, okay, I can use or I cannot use.
And in this whole process, it's important to you to keep that knowledge accessible. Like you said, the people that usually work with those softwares are not computer scientists like yourself. So softwares like, or solutions like Efficient BioEye, they're open source, so everyone can access them. But you also keep them very easy to handle, right? So you don't need to be able to code or something.
Correct. So we that is our goal. So we hope to make our tool easily accessible. And in order to make this really easily accessible for the biologists, not only for the method developers, we need to understand how what they prefer. So we did a lot of like collaborations with different labs, and so that we can better understand like whether this is really useful for them. And we will adjust our tools according to their feedbacks. We also do like international seminars, workshops, and conference, and show people what we are developing and asking for their feedbacks. So we constantly like improve our tools according to their feedbacks.
Now, throughout the conversation, you walked us through some recent developments in the field, especially in your group. What's your outlook for the future? Like, what do you think the next couple of years are going to bring?
Yes, I think a very important thing is community. So no matter is in terms of resource, energy, data storage, human knowledge, whatever, community is the key. So it will create a share space where we don't want to reinvent the wheel. For example, if I develop one model that which has been trained on millions of images, I hope other people can reuse that. They don't need to reinvent the wheel because I spend the energy already. If you want to do something similar, you don't need to re-spend this much amount of energy. You just use mine, and then you add your resource on top of it to fine-tune it or adapt it to your purpose. Then by doing this, we can greatly reduce the amount of energy, storage, and experts' time. So I totally believe in the next 5 years, at least in the bioimaging community, there will be some huge effort in our community to establish such collaborative effort.
The way you publish your work underlines this, like I said, everything's open access, and you also publish all of your code. Do you want to give a quick hint on where to find this?
Yes, of course, you can find us always on ESA's website, and our group also have our own like GitHub space. If you search MMV Lab, which is Microscopy Machine Vision Lab, then you can find our lab on GitHub, where we host all of our open source code there.
And then I know you're always open to have people come and reach out if they have questions or if they want to collaborate.
Of course, always, yeah.
If you would like to read more about the group's research, please visit our website at isas.de/compact. That's the German word for compact, so K-O-M-P-A-K-T. And if you're interested in working at ESAS, or if you don't want to miss any more news in general, then be sure to follow us on X, which is formerly known as Twitter, at ESAS_Leibniz. All that's left to do is thank you for listening and say until next time when I talk to a new person about an exciting topic here at ESAS.